Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In this world of increasing derangement, some things are more or less constant. Two guests in two segments today. The philosopher Olufemi Taiwo will clarify the issues around DEI, and the historian Sophia Rosenfeld will explore the meaning of choice in Western culture over the last two or three centuries. The three letters DEI, which in case you've forgotten stand for diversity, equity, and inclusion, have been at the center of our discourse in this second Trump era. The standard definition, this from Wikipedia, is organizational frameworks that seek to promote the fair treatment and full participation of all people, particularly groups who have historically been underrepresented or subject to discrimination based on identity or disability. At the root of this is something important, mitigating the effects of these discriminations and trying to prevent them from recurring. In practice, there's been a lot of silliness around it, which has annoyed many people, and not only bigots. But the bigots have seized on that annoyance and are using it to revive those discriminations. Trump and company have blamed DEI for wildfires and plane crashes, as if lesbians couldn't handle a fire hose or black people couldn't fly an aircraft. Here to set us straight in all this is Olufemi Taiwo, an associate professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. He was on this show a couple of years ago to talk about his book Elite Capture, an examination of how our rulers appropriated ideas associated first with the black socialist feminist Combahee River Collective and turned them into banal corporate formulas. I use another three-letter initialism in the interview, PMC, which is a familiar term to connoisseurs of this realm, but perhaps not to civilians. It stands for professional managerial class, a catch-all term that includes nurses and teachers along with coders and seven-figure lawyers. In other words, the better-off sections of the working class along with true functionaries of capital. It's an object of contempt for many on the right and some on the left, but the haters never really define their terms. Olufemi Taiwo. This fight over DEI looks like a battle between elites, you know, corporate liberals versus corporate reactionaries like Trump. Where does the broad population stand in relation to all this? Is this their fight?
Yes and no. What we're largely seeing is that working class people especially are just kind of collateral damage in this war of position between the forces of Musk and friends and essentially their workers, which is a kind of privileged slash non-privileged section of the working class. But there's a lot of resentment that's been built up towards DEI that I think comes from worker relations internal to big tech that is now being used to reshape the entire economy in the country.
What kind of worker reactions are you thinking of?
So essentially, the fights between Zuckerberg and Musk and their staff, obviously they were very ready and willing to be draconian to their factory workers, but their programmers, their tech people had a level of cultural say that maybe was different from the average shop floor. And so Facebook had comparatively to now pro-LGBTQ policies. Musk's Tesla was under investigation for various indiscretions, sexual harassment, racism at the factory level. And I think these guys just really never reconciled themselves to the cultural normal that they were forced for a limited amount of time to take seriously in their workplaces. And when the opportunity rose to take vengeance against everything that that represented, they, as bosses, rose to the occasion of doing exactly that.
This wokeness business can be traced, if you want to trace it to some sort of class origin or stratum origin, into the PMC, which people both left and right have a little bit disparaging words for. What do you make of this identification of the PMC as being so influential on one side, but also being so problematic?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely something to keep track of in terms of which class of people has the social power to enforce at least cosmetic pretensions towards diversity. Was the professional class that was up in arms or supposedly up in arms about these different cultural codes that are getting retroactively described as wokeness? these were the academics, these were the professionals able to insist on Black History Month and Juneteenth celebrations and to enforce pronoun norms in rooms where the actual powerful people might actually have to care what the norms are. There's something to keep track of just in terms of explanation if we're trying to think of who the sides of the culture war that's playing out in the presses and in particular workplaces. We're trying to keep track of what sides there are. But the people shaping the actual platforms at scale, the people who own the platforms, the people who own the businesses, are the same people they've always been. They're not professional managers, they're business owners and shareholders.
There was this discourse around elites where they became like the English department at Yale and not the owners of corporations. It's a weird analysis of elites. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think people are confusing a kind of cultural power with a sort of overarching power. It would be like walking into somebody's home, seeing that the wife did the decorations, and then deciding with no other information about society that you're in a matriarchal society. At some point, you have to answer the question of how one form of power relates to all the other ones that we might be worried about. And while the English department at Yale might get to decide the tenor of a conversation about the word Latinx or whatever, there was never any real reason to think that these people were deciding the pace of inflation or whether factories open or close or whether offshoring accelerates or decelerates, all the things that are really basically fundamental to how people experience the economy and how they experience their life. And we've just somehow gotten away from thinking that those things are important politically, or at least keeping track of the world accordingly.
Sometimes I think it's kind of personal for these guys. Like Bill Ackman's daughter went to Harvard and became a Marxist of some sort, and Elon Musk's daughter transitioned. And I think some of these guys just take this as a betrayal. Betrayal of their parental powers and class backgrounds. But it does seem to have some kind of personal edge that the younger generation confuses and frightens them.
Yeah, I think it has a deeply personal edge. You know, I think the family connections are a good example of how much more personal it gets beyond just the workplace stuff I was talking about before, where maybe their high-placed professional managerial class employees are demanding that they respect the pronouns of the other people on the board calls or something like that. But in either case, you have people who are used to experiencing much of the world as something that they can control. Elon Musk effectively has bought the country at this point, but he can't buy respect from his daughter. Neither can Bill Ackman. And so these people who otherwise don't have to really negotiate, otherwise don't have to respect other people, were temporarily in this situation where they had to at least pay lip service to other people's view of the world and perspective of the world, and they deeply resented it. And now they have an opportunity to kind of erase that from the history.
Now, if we step back to a few years ago, there are those moments in 2021, 2022 when capital went woke, to use that word again. J.P. Morgan Chase chair Jamie Dimon started talking about structural racism. Customers of that bank, like me, signed onto the website and got a splash screen that used that phrase. It's hard to believe that was only a few years ago, and now it's like the snows of yesteryear gone. How did you understand that moment? Were they just trying to co-opt a popular rebellion, something else going on? How do you read it?
I think they were trying to co-opt a popular rebellion, but I think they were also doing that because they were trying to understand what the currents of the moment were. You know, I think the moral etiquette follows what people think the balance of power is culturally and what they can get away with. There's always some noise between consumers, the broader cultural elite, you know, what's going to get these people laughed out of the Kennedy Center or, you know, scoffed at their fancy dinners or whatever. And there's always, you know, a little bit of fog of war going on. And so they saw these people in the streets and thought maybe that's where the energy is culturally. And now that Musk has bought and Nazified Twitter, now that the right wing is electorally ascendant, they're feeling a bit bolder about what they can get away with on the cultural plane.
Funny you mentioned the Kennedy Center. Now it's Trump's Kennedy Center.
The Trump Center.
God knows what they're going to mount there now with him in charge. But now the corporate diversity initiatives, all that stuff, goes back much further than that moment of 21-22 when Jamie Dimon was all concerned about structural racism. What gave rise to that? What were they trying to do? What were the politics of that? Was it just managing a diverse workforce or some larger goal? How do you see it?
I think there was a kind of interest convergence between a fraction of the capitalist class generally, and I guess you could call it the economic elite of the racial justice struggle / just the economic and cultural elite among people of color, among the ascendant women post fuller gender integration of higher education and of the executive classes. Both sides of this kind of saw an opportunity in the new moral normal that emerged after the civil rights movement and in response to the civil rights movement. It was clear that the previous kind of formal apartheid Jim Crow era was not going to fit with the new normal, but too much change, say substantive wealth redistribution, wouldn't necessarily be to the common interests either of the black 1% or the regular 1%. They converged on a kind of agenda that was, if not singularly, then primarily focused on admissions in really elite universities, diversity initiatives at the managerial level, the kinds of things that would really strongly shape the life opportunities of the most advantaged people of color, and that would also give political cover to the people now directing power and capital their way. More or less the story, the cynical story that your average, very lefty, cultural, class reductionist kind of person tells, where, you know, this is the thing that power did instead of socialism or something like that, right? That's more or less the story, but it's these two classes kind of finding something to agree upon in the reconstruction after a previous political moment that upset the status quo.
I'm speaking with the philosopher Olofemi Taiwo. And then, of course, DEI became its own industry with its own interests.
So, yes. You
know, quite the racket. I think a lot of people who had to go through those, say, corporate diversity programs found it rather off-putting. So, I mean, there's a certain degree of basis for the resentment of a lot of that stuff, just in people's experience of having had fingers wagged at them by human resources managers.
Yeah, absolutely. The same things that explain why the actual reconstruction couldn't be too substantive, couldn't be real deep economic redistribution, because that's against the economic interests of the 1%. It's also a reason why the diversity trainings couldn't be too actually incisive, because that too would be against both the economic and the sort of ideological interests of the 1%. So you got instead this kind of milquetoast, weird, deeply weird culture around DEI that was superficially invested in analysis of the social problems that it was responding to. And people kind of sense that, you know, whether or not they have a cultural studies PhD level understanding of the social issues, they know that it's more complicated than what the diversity seminar is saying. And whether or not they feel equipped to challenge it is another thing, but that's going to build a level of justified resentment when you have to sit through someone half explain your experience to you and do so in a way that marks you as the problem or in need of moral reconstruction by this obviously flawed source.
To use your phrase, there was some elite capture here. There was something originally that was real and important, which started as, say, black liberation or feminism, got banalized into silly parables and exercises. So the critique of DEI is in some sense anti-elitist, but it's in a very limited way. There's something there to that critique of elitism.
Yeah, absolutely. These were top-down initiatives. They were put in place for reasons that suited the boardrooms and very few other people, except, as we were just talking about, the kind of cottage industry that built up around DEI. There's a lot to reflect on. There's a lot of justified resentment towards that. But just as DEI was kind of an elite project, it's important to note, as I think we'd both agree, that the resistance to DEI is just as much an elite project in and of itself. They're not really trying to get global fairness for the people who had to sit through board meetings. They're using that resentment to pursue a whole different project, which somehow, for some reason, involves Elon Musk having all of our social security numbers.
Yeah, it keeps coming back to him now, doesn't
it? Yeah.
The anti-wokesters, like Trump and Musk, we can certainly see that there's some validity to the critique of DEI, but these guys really look like they're jonesing for a revival of bigotry and segregation. We've got Musk and Trump portraying Afrikaners as the real victims of South Africa. How do we rescue the worthy core of the critique of DEI from these debased characters?
Yeah, the response to the post-apartheid South Africa was really, really on the nose there. The way that we get back the core of what was important and what was useful about DEI is by tying it back to the story of redistribution of economic and political power, which is the only real way to make headway on racial justice or gender justice or any of these other things that we're cosmetically dealing with when we talk about DEI. And that means tying it to organized labor, tenants' rights movements, making those struggles one big struggle.
There's a left version of the critique of DEI. It draws attention to diversity. That fragments us when there should be attempts to unify us. I hear, yes, there is truth to this, but it also seems like a premature reconciliation of differences. Racism is real. Sexism is real. How do we navigate this? How do we separate this desire to critique the bogus from the need to do something about these real oppressions and hierarchies?
I think we have to claim a kind of universalist politics, not as a alternative to thinking about racial justice or taking gender justice seriously or taking transphobia seriously, but we have to start stitching those movements together with the kind of full-throated acknowledgement that this is actually not our alternative to those, but this is how we're going to get those other things done, right? If we want to amass the power that it's going to take to deal with mass incarceration or to deal with transphobic healthcare systems and build ones that don't have incredibly high rates of black maternal mortality, for instance, the power that's going to take to build that isn't going to be built by just having a better analysis of the real fact of racism or the real fact of misogyny. It's going to involve building power within all of the groups that are affected by those, which it turns out is almost all of us. You know, even if we're affected differently, even if some of us are affected more directly than others, we only have the one country, the one infrastructure, the one healthcare system, and what it's going to take to rebuild those in a way that's compatible with justice for all has to respond to the specific injustices for some that add up to a system that is not just for all.
There's a lot of critique of a lot of left organizations, left spaces, that they're dominated by white men. In an organization I'm part of, DSA, we're often criticized in New York City for being a predominantly white organization, and we have opportunistic black politicians and landlords using that critique. It's just white organizations exercising white privilege. Problem is, there is a little degree of truth to that. How do we sort that out? How do we resist that kind of critique and also address the fact that, you know, our organizations are too white for their own good?
I think there is some truth to the criticism. And this is one of the things that coalitional politics ideally would respond to. It's less a question from my perspective of necessarily changing the ranks of DSA directly. The people who want to join DSA should be encouraged to join DSA. But finding ways to earn trust, not as purveyors of a criticism, but as members in good standing of organizational coalitions. Some years ago, I was also in DSA. I was in a chapter that was working in coalition with some other orgs, including ones that had very different demographics. And I don't think anything that we said or any way that we phrased our arguments won us a particular amount of credibility with those other organizations. I think it was the actions that we led and the risks that we were willing to take on the basis of for the cause that all of us in that coalition were getting together to fight for, which was to fight against ICE in LA. That's not to say that we were perfect or we won total trust from everyone, but I think that kind of relation building through action organizing is the only way to respond to those kinds of criticisms. When people know what you're about and trust what you're about, then they will worry less what you look like.
It sounds like you're saying that the best resistance to this, you know, anti-DEI, anti-woke business is not so much rhetorical, but action, making coalitions and doing things rather than just trying to argue with people with debased motives.
Absolutely. And preferably doing things that work, right? Winning campaigns. I think there's obviously something to be said for fighting the good fight, speaking truth to power, but we're entering an era where a lot is at risk. And I think if we can be effective and in genuine solidarity with orgs that have different demographics, different identities of people, being effective for those causes is the best kind of answer to this problem.
I think there's often a discomfort among predominantly white organizations about making those coalitions. We feel guilty about our privilege, and that inhibits any kind of actual solidarity, it seems. That guilt about privilege is not a very healthy impulse, is it?
It's not at all. If anything, I think it's a kind of subtle, insidious form of counter-organizing for exactly this reason, right? It prevents exactly the connections that we might need to win some of these fights because people are worried about being the wrong kind of partners, comrades, allies in those fights. And so a thing we're going to have to build along the way is a patience for some initial skepticism, some initial accusations of bad faith. The only way out of those is through, I think.
That was the philosopher Olufemi Taiwo. His book, Lead Capture, was published a couple of years ago by Haymarket. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
In cold sweats through late summer, blood traces on the ground. The dry earth cracks and shadows grow, a dying sun sinks down. Horrors and cold slaughter, silent mystery, staring down the winding sheet draped across the trees. And back up in the city, I watch the falling leaves blown wild across the courtyard and gathered.
That was some of Fallen Leaves, new from the Mekongs. Next, a history of choice. Choice of a consumer product, of a mate, of a religion, of a political leader, of whether to have a baby or not, is so pervasive in our world that we never really think about it. But like lots of things we don't think about, it has a history, one most directly traceable to the 18th century. Sophia Rosenfeld, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, is just out with a book on the topic, The Age of Choice, A History of Freedom in Modern Life, published by Princeton University Press. Her earlier books include Common Sense, A Political History, and Democracy and Truth. Sophia Rosenfeld. Choice is one of those things, you know, like the proverbial fish swimming in water. They don't recognize it. It's so pervasive in our lives. How did you come to, as they say, problematize the matter of choice?
It's true. Choice is something that we encounter constantly. There's nobody out there who hasn't picked something off a menu of options in recent years, but it's not something we do with much thought. And I like that kind of subject. I like to think about the things that we do a lot of, that we believe in, and that we don't usually talk about because they seem so natural in a way. So I guess there are two ways I came to the question of writing a book on choice, and which sounds like a sort of strange topic. It could be the history of everything. One part of this was trying to understand better the shared basic assumptions that democracies depend upon these days, and choice is one of them. It's sort of one of the unacknowledged factors. That's the sort of more political reason. The more personal reason is that, like a lot of people, I think, we're told sort of subtly all the time that choice making is freedom as we experience it in modern life. And yet a lot of us, myself included, often find making even small choices rather difficult. And I wondered about both the political impact of our emphasis on choice and on the personal impact, what it means to experience freedom as kind of equivalent of picking something off a menu all the time.
Let's talk some about the history. Early part of the book, you look at shopping, not just as a form of getting stuff you need, but also as a kind of recreation, a social activity. So how did shopping evolve into something that we now understand it?
It's true that in some ways there's a kind of strange parallelism that develops in both our political life and in our life as consumers, which we're picking things all the time. Voting, we know, goes back to basically the beginning of democracies in the modern world. But shopping, we don't think about as having a history very often. And that history has primarily 18th century roots. The term itself in English, shopping, is invented in the 1790s, more or less, to talk about this new activity, which isn't the same as just going to a market and saying, you know, I need a chicken and getting one and paying for it. It's this activity that we're very familiar with of browsing possibilities, looking and weighing the criteria for making a selection. Some of that selection coming from constraints, like the funds we have, but some of it coming from our preferences. Do we like the blue fabric or the red fabric better? Is a choice often just simply about what do I like at some level, although, of course, it's influenced by advertising and other things. But that said, it's stores, fixed location places where you could see the options, where women went out, especially in groups, to look at the options, to decide if they wanted to buy something, is an activity that emerges in cities. Late 17th into 18th century, London, Paris, Amsterdam are particularly known for having these shops. They're something of a tourist attraction by around 1800.
Shopping was very much identified with women and a whole lot of perils around that. Sluttishness, fickleness, you know, excess. For the men who indulge in it, there's a disreputable effeminacy surrounding it. There's a perception of moral decay through consumption. Buying things beyond one's social rank threatened the social hierarchy. So it's really a social and ideological minefield from its early days.
It is, absolutely. And one reason I do write a lot about women is that they probably experienced it in some ways the most. On the one hand, the very first kind of modern-looking choosers are women doing this thing, probably middle-class women largely, and who take up shopping as a kind of a slightly daring new activity that women could take part in outside the home. So in some ways, the women are the first real choosers, but they're also heavily tainted by association with this new activity. It doesn't have the moral seriousness of certain kinds of choice making. It seems frivolous. We use different words, but shopping is always described as something women do on a whim or based on their fancy. And so I was really interested in the fact that choice, which is so central to modern life, is both associated with women, debased because of that association, and ultimately becomes kind of aspirational for women. Women start asking about choice making in a variety of realms beyond just the commercial.
It's been a long time since I read Sister Carrie, but as I remember, her moral fall was partly occasioned by shopping.
In the 19th century novel, it's all over the place, and into the early 20th century, from Madame Bovary to the great department store novels of the late 19th century, shopping does nothing good for women in the long run.
Well, is it a sexual or erotic metaphor to some degree?
It can be. It can be about the coquette, is famously this figure of 18th century onwards, who has a little more independence than the typical woman because she has a mind and uses it, but she picks suitors, she picks goods that she likes, and usually the coquette gets punished in the end.
Religion became a realm of choice as well. You talk about how one's choice of religion became a choice.
Yeah, we don't think about religion and choice very often, in part because most of the time people's religion is determined by the family they were born into. But the story of choice in the modern world, I think, isn't just a story of sort of commercial culture and shopping run wild. It doesn't explain, for instance, the origin of the idea of choosing your own reading, choosing the ideas that you want to hold. That comes from a sort of separate story in the Western world. And that's the story of what happens after the Reformation. Two important things happen, I think. One is that what used to be a unified Christianity breaks apart. And suddenly not only is there Protestantism and Catholicism, but there are all these different possible sects within Protestantism. That opened up, just as in the realm of shopping and really colonial culture, which opened up this idea of many possible goods out there.
Well, even today, when people move to a new town, they go church shopping.
Nowadays they do, right. And so this, the first thing that happens is kind of a pluralism, and you see it particularly in the New World, which becomes the United States later on, where colonies are created, where the whole purpose, in fact, is to create a haven for different religious sects. But inevitably, that produces the effect of, say, in 18th century Philadelphia, you could go on a Sunday and try out sermons in a number of different churches. Sounds odd to us as entertainment, perhaps, but plenty of people did this. They'd go hear the Quakers in the morning and go hear the Moravians later in the day. That's, I think, an extremely interesting phenomenon, and it happens in concert with the rise of bookstores, lending libraries, the kinds of things that allowed people access to multiple options in the sphere of ideas. And that's coupled, I'll just say this, with a part of Protestantism that also emphasizes freedom of conscience and the idea that one shouldn't just automatically adopt the ideas that are given to them in a catechism, but that one should, in a sense, assent to what is right and true, which again involves, sometimes it's actually even called religious choice as well as freedom of conscience. So these two things make possible a new attitude towards ideas. And eventually, this is secularized, not exclusively. We still church shop, as you say, but a similar kind of ethos around ideas spreads beyond the religious sphere, also into a whole realm of entertainments. It's the reason why we go into a bookstore, Barnes & Noble, and browse the tables and think, what appeals to me to read?
Something I'd never thought about before, which you have a chapter on, are the commonplace books and their evolution in the 18th and 19th century, from a collection of snippets to a creation of a worldview, a construction or representation of a self. What about the importance of commonplace books? What exactly were they, and how did they develop over time?
I think of a commonplace book to this day as a little like a cross between a scrapbook and a journal. They don't make much sense in a world in which people, say, read one text over and over again, say the Bible. But in a world in which you read multiple things, now we might save them as tabs or something like that. But in a world in which people read a lot, how do you store an idea? Commonplace books become like a personal storage system for things that really appeal to you. You might jot down a conversation you had. You might jot down a poem that you either wrote or copied out of something else. A lot of this material was copied out of other things. And I tend to think of it as a place where you've chosen the things that appeal to you in the realm of ideas. They're once used largely just as a kind of memory device, but over time they become a kind of way to explain yourself. People pass them down to other people, for instance. People read aloud from them. They become somewhat of a self-defining enterprise. If you go into any library in America that has a collection of rare books and manuscripts, you can find lots and lots of people have given papers containing commonplace books where people famous, but also people really obscure, have collected their thoughts and their reading habits as if they put them in a file drawer for posterity. And sometimes they've added illustrations. Sometimes they add newspaper clippings, locks of hair, anything you can think of. And I loved looking through them.
It wasn't just upper class people, and it wasn't just men who did these, right?
No, and that's what's interesting. It starts out as kind of a gentleman's habit or a scholar's habit, but women take up this practice. Increasingly, women become some of the big readers, and they are not exclusively written by people with lots of leisure time. There are workers' versions, ordinary women's versions. It ceases to be a kind of aristocratic habit, and some of the most interesting are ones where, say, a carpenter has collected snippets of his writing. Amazing sources for thinking about how people envisioned themselves in the past, especially people who it's often hard to have much sense of how did they really see themselves unless they were big diary keepers, and many people were not.
People make bad choices, and there are always people who want to constrain the choices they can make. So how did people think about this as the society of choice developed?
there are both liberatory and pernicious effects of this leaning into choice, we might say. The emancipatory ones we're pretty familiar with because they're part of our rhetoric, that you get to be a fully developed self, that you get what you want, and you get respect from other people as autonomous when you're a choice maker. And that's why so many human rights ideas today are framed really around choosing. It's a strange kind of freedom in many ways. It's not the right to any kind of necessities. It's only the right to make selections. None of these human rights decrees say anything about the constraints, whether they're economic or familial or religious or anything else that might make choice-making extremely bounded in almost all cases. And beyond that, the idea that we're responsible for our own choices, often it can be a kind of punishment to tell people who have nothing but bad choices that you made the wrong one and you're responsible for the outcomes, when so much of what the outcomes are often a matter either of luck or structural disadvantages, is to blame individuals for whatever outcomes they encounter. Even bad health, which would seem to be the most random of things, could be said, well, you didn't make the right health choices. You didn't pick a good doctor. You didn't pick a healthy lifestyle. We blame people a lot, as if life were nothing but a series of selections that we make almost in a vacuum.
Throughout history, there have been critics of this culture of choice, both from the right, who wanted to constrain them in the interests of stability and social hierarchy, and the left, like Marx, who said it concealed an entire structure of exploitation, coercion, unfreedom. Yeah, so it's not always been applauded, this development of choice.
No, it has not. It seems now to run across the political spectrum in the U.S. We fight about who should be doing the choosing, and we fight about what should be the options on the table. But the framing of choice as always good is evident from everything from school choice on the right to reproductive choice on the left. So there are very few people position themselves in American public life as critics of choice. That said, there have always been critics, and we are all critical in certain areas because there are always certain parts of any culture that, one, are isolated from choice. We say, you can't choose that. That's not a good choice. Or we restrict certain people from certain kinds of choices at different moments. Choice is always bounded and always restricted in various ways, and it's always had its critics for some very good reasons and some ones that we might be suspicious of.
I'm speaking with Sophia Rosenfeld, author of The Age of Choice, just out from Princeton University Press. Back to some specific realms here. Marriage, the choice of a mate, a choice that forecloses any other choices in the romantic realm very often. Men and women had different realms of choice, as did members of various classes. So how did this notion of marriage as the realm of choice develop over the 18th and 19th centuries in Western Europe?
Some of this is not new. The idea that marriage should involve consent is very old. It belongs to Christian tradition, and it belongs even to Roman tradition. For most of Western history, and still in many parts of the world, the idea of two autonomous people contracting with each other, sort of independent of family and town or anybody else, it sounds like a very strange way to organize society. Letting two young people figure it out on their own is a pretty modern idea. And it is not one that had much to do with freedom for most of history. In fact, one of the perks, you might say, of having a high social standing in the past, especially in Europe, was that so many of these things didn't have to be decided upon. You were already betrothed to somebody. You already knew where you were going to live. You already knew where your income was going to come from. None of this idea of that freedom is getting to select anything you want, and the bigger the marketplace, the better. Over the course of the 18th into 19th centuries, what starts not as an aristocratic practice, but is increasingly a kind of middle class practice, trickles down into the lower classes, insofar as people find themselves in cities in particular, often far from family, and having to suss out who other people are without knowing everything about them the way you might if you lived in a small village somewhere. And this was seemed both liberating and terrifying, because a bad choice, especially a bad choice for a woman, spelled nothing but doom. A young woman who found herself, say, jilted or pregnant without out of wedlock in a city had almost nothing she could do at that point except resort to prostitution. The options were few. In this context, you know, we laugh now about things like Tinder as helping us navigate the world of meeting people. But there are a lot of earlier versions of Tinder, which are to say choice apparati that help filter out who would match you. There are newspaper ads starting the late 18th century in France saying, you know, wanted a wife with the following criteria, or I'm a woman and I'm looking for the following things. One of the things that emerges to help with this process, dating doesn't really come into play until the 20th century. Sounds a little too risky, but all sorts of forms of dances, public balls, private balls, working class balls, all offer some small early opportunity to make selections in a crowd of people that you don't know. And of course, the only way to make that work is to create an incredible number of rules to go with the picking process to make sure that nobody is setting themselves up for disaster by making the wrong choice.
Now, there's a tension in thoughts around marriage between the contract side of it and the passion side of it. How are those reconciled?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I mean, to this day, of course, right? It's a legal...
Or have they ever been reconciled?
Yeah, right. I mean, and to this day, people tend to marry people of similar class backgrounds, similar earning potential, that sort of thing. We don't really look at the world as an open book of possibilities very often, or at least that's not who we end up with. Two things emerge together that sound a little strange to us, but one is the romantic idea today of love and passion as the basis of a relationship, and the other is an increasingly contractual sense of marriage. It's a formalization of something that you do. It provides certain benefits, and also you make the choice to, as you say, give up other choices, though divorce becomes the buyer's remorse option by the late 19th century, too, that if you really made a bad choice, you can get out of it and have the possibility of contracting again. And divorce doesn't sound very romantic, except for the fact that it only makes sense if you think that a relationship should be built on compatibility and some kind of emotional, passionate relationship to the other person. These are pretty recent developments, though, and they're most familiar to us, really, by reading literature. If you read the great 19th century novels, most of them are about a woman who's torn between just what you're talking about, what would be economically beneficial, what her parents want, and the appeal of a particular other person who's not necessarily the right person, but the person that is most desired by the heroine.
Throughout a lot of what you write about, this notion of choice from the shopping days of the 18th century to the present with all these consumer sciences around trying to figure out what we want and how to sell it to us, it all depends upon this model of homo economicus, the rational self-maximizer, people with preferences all rank ordered, what Keynes called the extraordinary contraption of the Benthamite school. What about homo economicus? Is that really an accurate model of how humans think and act?
One thing that I think is really fascinating in all of this is that by the 20th century, just as you say, there start to be sciences around choice making. From psychology to economics to marketing, these are all essentially claims that not only can we discover how people decide and what they decide, but that with this data, we can do a lot of other things. Once we know more about humans and choice making, we can either lead them to make better choices, or we can lead them to make the choices we want them to make, or we can create policy. And of course, we see this in the sort of growing dominance of economics as a science in the latter part of the 20th century. The interesting thing I think that happens in economics, particularly since you're asking about homo economicus, which is really a stock figure. It's not a psychological portrait of a human. It's an imagined human that economists use to theorize with. But it's a very stripped down version of a human. And sometimes it gets taken rather literally. It's a person who, as you say, knows their own mind, has all the information necessary, and goes out into marketplaces of all kinds, whether it's a market for a spouse or a market for a vacuum cleaner, and knows what they prefer and chooses that which they prefer. And if they did it a different day, they'd pick the same thing all over again, because that's just what their preferences are in life. It's had enormous effects that we think often of the chooser in this rational mode. Today's behavioral economists often tell us that this is wrong, that we're really not that good at making choices, that we constantly pick the wrong thing, our preferences change from day to day, even having more information doesn't really help. And that all sounds very innovative, except for the fact that I think anything from mythology onwards has told us that actually humans are complex creatures and make a lot of decisions that aren't in their best interest all the time, collectively and individually. But we've been quite taken with this notion of the human as a naturalized chooser for quite some time. And I see this as the end result, in a way, of the merging of capitalism and liberal democracy, where both modes have imagined the citizen, the consumer, as a picker of things. And therefore, why not try to imagine humans and make policy around them in this mode? I see that as a limited way of thinking about humans.
Throughout the book, you write about the role of choice in feminist thinking over the centuries. Mary Wollstonecraft touted choice for women but sneered at pursuits like shopping and novel reading, which are things that women chose to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the language around choice and abortion has been very pervasive since the 1970s. What about the role of choice in feminist thinking? How fruitful has it been?
It's a great question, and maybe the jury's still out. I'm starting to think it might have exhausted itself in a certain way. So feminism grows up really in tandem in its most mainstream form with liberalism. So it's not an accident that John Stuart Mill, in the middle of the 19th century, who's kind of the great theorist of choice in the broadest sense, choice in politics, choice in profession and education, starts saying, if women are autonomous beings, shouldn't they have some choices too? Maybe he didn't imagine all the choices that men have, but he imagined a choice as a realm women could enter as well. And you see the same sort of ideas emerging in early women's suffrage movement, saying, but we already choose in these other spheres. Shouldn't we have choice to a greater degree in politics? And then can we have choice about when we're going to be mothers? Can we have choice in a greater sense about our sexual identities? All of this follows in a pattern. And so by the 1970s, second wave feminism, right after Roe v. Wade is decided, it actually seems to the leaders of many of the major women's rights organizations as if the most uncontroversial framing of the abortion issue is not going to be population control. It's not going to be equal rights. It's not going to be health justice. It's going to be simply, why can't we choose? Because this has been a mode that's now not novel at all in the 70s to say, you don't have to like abortion. You don't have to do it yourself. You just let everybody choose what's best for them. So in some ways, it was meant to be uncontroversial. Of course, we know it didn't work out that way. We know that the right to life came back with an attack on the choice model. And in very recent years, we've seen some shifts. It's still there, of course, but there have been some more talk of things like reproductive justice as alternatives to the choice model, which still always runs the risk, especially where women are concerned, of sounding like it's just a lifestyle issue or really a form of shopping. Like the same as saying, I like the blue cloth or the red cloth would be, I choose abortion versus I choose to have a baby.
Finally, I know historians are often reluctant to draw conclusions or offer prescriptions, but after studying this concept throughout mostly Western history, where are you? Is choice exhausted? Do we want to be relieved from the burden of picking over some pre-chosen and unappealing options? Is it too limited a view of human behavior, more a realm of atomized individuals than some kind of lively social formation? Yeah, where are we?
I don't mind being that historian who has opinions and thoughts, and you know what I really hope is not that somebody comes away from this necessarily agreeing entirely with me, but at least thinking about the possibility that choice isn't always the answer. We tend to always be suggesting that more options for more people, more opportunities for choice is always a good thing. And I'm interested in the fact that obviously nobody wants to be sort of opposed to choice. That's a form of coercion. Nobody's going to frame what you want to see the future look like in that form. That said, there are realms in which the exaltation of choice, I think, has gone too far and where we are suffering as a result. Some of this is at the personal level, as I mentioned, but a lot of it is about our collective lives together. We are not better off, for instance, having 9 lousy-looking insurance plans for healthcare in front of us, none of which we can decipher, none of which allow us to know what we're going to need when. Most of us, I think, would much prefer not having choice in health insurance and simply having one good plan. And then there are whole areas, like, for instance, clean air or clean water, in which individual choices might actually work against what we all need and should be sharing, which is some kind of way of ensuring a collective prescription of good air and good water. But, for instance, the recent executive orders of President Trump saying he's bringing back freedom of choice in appliances, light bulbs, cars, that kind of individual choice not only leaves us incapable of working together, but collectively makes it impossible for us to have less energy consumption collectively. It's a kind of choice that has negative effects on the whole. And the emphasis on choice doesn't give us much help in dealing with those sorts of situations. I'm really interested in stripping away the idea that choice is always freedom. It's always, to my mind, a kind of bounded freedom.
Finally, how do you feel now when you walk into a supermarket? Are you not only burdened by the choices on offer, but knowing the very history of choice itself?
I know, it's hard not to see this everywhere. If you want to illustrate an article on choice, the most common illustration tends to be either the breakfast cereal aisle or the toothpaste aisle. And I don't know, I mean, we've all had the experience of you go to buy a toothpaste right in there, 50 different kinds, all maybe made by Crest, I'm not sure. That's maybe a fairly benign example, but it should cause us to at least ask, what are we gaining from having this kind of excessive choice? When is it too much? When I go to Amazon and I want to buy, you know, a pair of socks, do I want 50,000 options? Probably not. Those are not the worst examples, perhaps, but I think it should cause us to at least think, on what basis are we putting ourselves in this kind of market-like scenario, and why, over and over again? And what does it do to our larger ways of thinking that all kinds of menus and options are part of how we navigate everyday life? You started with the idea that this seems natural and it's one of those things like fish swimming in water that maybe we need to call attention to. That really is the goal of the book. And I think there are political payoffs to questioning this conceit.
That was Sophia Rosenfeld, author of The Age of Choice, just published by Princeton University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a behind-the-news favorite. We are all bourgeois now, from McCarthy. Till next week, bye.